World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 466 because these broadcasts are numbered and put on tape cassettes. And it's November the 9th, 1980. This has been a very traumatic week for me with the elections because in my first published article in 1972, I warned and mentioned the succession of Ronald Reagan as President of the United States. It's a miserable concept, knowing who is behind him, the powers that be are behind him. But the most depressing thing about this election and what the future has to bring isn't Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or Henry Kissinger or Mr. Casey or Richard Allen. It's the indifference of the victims that they can't act or function any better than they could in Germany when Hitler came to power. Just specifically the Jewish intellects, the professors, teachers, doctors, fell down. They let Hitler come to power. He published in Mein Kampf what he was going to do. They elected him in. They fell for the Reichstag story. They let the radicals be rounded up. They considered them the troublemakers. The radicals were warning them about what was going to come down. They ignored the handwriting on the wall everywhere, and even at the time of their own extinction, they ignored the gas chambers and believed most of them or a lot of them is going to be a shower, or they were going to some work farms. The pathetic thing was that they had no example to live up to or to watch or to know, but years have passed since World War II, and there are thousands of books, literally many, many thousands of books, paperback, library, new books, old books, on the subject of the resurrection of the Fourth Reich and how it would continue when World War II was over. And the Jewish community, the blacks, the Chicanos, the students, the young people are unwilling to spend the time to read or study. And that is the tragedy of the human condition. I had a long talk with a friend this week who teaches at the university here. We gave two semester courses on the assassination. And neither of us felt too depressed because being somewhat existential or philosophical, we have to accept the fact that each of us have done all that we could do up to this point and will continue to do. But I'm just speaking for myself now. I'm not here to save you. You have to save yourself. I'm not here to give advice because you don't want it. I could tell you what I think you should do to rise up against the conditions you're going to face, but you can't even visualize what you're going to face. I have to do my work, and you do your work. And the purpose of my being on the air 9 years or maybe 9 more years, as long as I can, or writing or lecturing, is to illustrate to people that the answers to the question, will we have World War III, are there, or are the Nazis resurging? The answers are there. Do we have control of our own destiny? The answer is in many books that people have had it when they had the will to take control of their own destiny. And there's also much literature to support the fact that when people don't want to do anything, they get swallowed up. I am a workaholic, and I am a survivor, in a sense. I want to survive, and I want to understand life to the best that I can. I'm living in this year. I want to understand what brought these events on and what the future has, as bad as it is. I'm not afraid to look into literature or books or candidates or people and see what they're going to bring down. But it's something that I'm interested in personally, and if other people are interested, we share this information and we share literature and books and facts. But that isn't enough to arouse most people to get away from the entertainment, to unplug the TV, to have dialogues, to get more literature, to write to more public officials, to call more talk shows, to pitch in there. And I really have to respect the moral majority or that group that gave Congress the heave-ho, and we'll go over some of those names soon. They had a purpose, and the purpose was something they all agreed upon. And they went after it, and they got what they wanted, and what they didn't get this time, they'll get 2 years from now, and then 2 years from then. And they are not going to be confused to this, to their purpose. If you get 12 people organized, such as the group that was organized nationally, in a room, they all went with one idea of mind of what kind of society they wanted, what they didn't want, who voted against the things that they believed in, and who supported the things that they believed in, and who would get rid of the people that they didn't want. And they put their money there, they put their time there, they wrote letters, they had Mr. Richard Vogery in Washington, and they had a mailing list, and they worked their butts off, and they got what they wanted, and what they didn't get, they'll get next time. And you have to really sit back and respect those people, because no matter what things they're doing, whether it's television or ball games or booze or alcohol or whatever they're doing, they still have time to sit together and discuss what kind of a world they think they want. And if it doesn't include you, that's your problem. Whether you're black or Jewish or poor or middle class, white or on welfare or handicapped in any way, they don't want you. That's for you to figure out how to survive. They figured out a way to pull the rug out from under you. You're superfluous. They don't need you. And it's up to you to prove that you are alive. And that is the question, how many people, as opposed to that group, are alive. There were 200 million or more people in this country, and 50% of those went out and voted, and the others stayed home. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a while. I have a list of about 16 different topics, and obviously we can't do them all in 1 week. That's always a problem. So I'll run down some of the things about the election first and have more to say on that in the weeks to come. Mr. Henry Kissinger was asked, would he accept the job of Secretary of State? And Henry Kissinger replied, this was in the New York Times, it would be, in quotes, the height of arrogance to reject such an important position out of hand, end quote. Henry Kissinger, who should be hung by his heels like Mussolini, or chased away, or possibly murdered like Adolf Hitler, or hung at Nuremberg, a man that desecrated and ruined Southeast Asia and changed the lives for the people in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, Thailand, and all over Southeast Asia, is still considered a man of reason and intelligence and meet the press and face the nation and chase Manhattan and the various government advisors and the Council of Foreign Relations use him and talk with him as if he were a distinguished man. I consider him a war criminal. And when he has such great manners to say it would be the height of arrogance, just translated, he's been kissing every candidate's behind through the entire campaign, groveling for any position he can get, and traveling around with Ronald Reagan. Of course, Ronald Reagan's team doesn't like Henry Kissinger. He's too far left for them, and they don't want any part of him because they consider him a radical left-winger. This team is in for business, and they don't want any fools like Kissinger around. But Kissinger may get his handle on some job with Ronald Reagan. The whole team is so polluted that one more or less isn't going to make much difference. There's a book that came out by a man who works for RAND Corporation, a government agency, published by Columbia University Press, that I have in my library. It's called The Faces of Power, Constancy and Change in United States Foreign Power, and it's the period of Harry Truman and the atomic bomb and the Cold War and the Dulles brothers and that whole ugly episode of American history that we're still experiencing up through Lyndon Johnson, the assassination of John Kennedy, and the manipulation of power during the Johnson administration. And it covers the time periods of, as I say, from 1948 through the Johnson administration on the use of American power in Cuba, Laos, Congo, Berlin, Cuban Missile Crisis, and so forth, or Alan Dulles' Psychology of Power, and so forth. But the point about the book, which is really interesting in the use of power, is a point that the author makes where he says, I'm going to quote this from the book, he says, the powerful are those who have large purposes and can accomplish them. So if you are knocked out of this scene, if you feel weak, much of the reason for that is because you don't have noble purposes and you can't accomplish anything unless you have some purpose in life other than just existing. This author says to accomplish these purposes, men usually require some degree of consent from other people. The ability to induce consent from others is the essence of political power. The fact that Ronald Reagan, with the background that he had in California, as a governor at Isla Vista or at the University of California, or closing the mental hospitals, or cutting the underpinnings out of the students, the poor, and so forth, always talking about the welfare cheaters, the fact that Carter threw in the election in California because it was all Reagan's, tells you something about the genius of Ronald Reagan to have power. He induced this consent without having what you would call a physical military junta or a coup. There was a time where people thought there would be martial law under Ronald Reagan or rather Richard Nixon or a coup d'etat to grab power at a certain time when Ronald Reagan was working on the garden plot. He said this was a plan of emergency in the United States, and at the meetings he said if people knew I was here and what I was doing, they'd think it was a plan to take over the country. Well, the country really was taken over November 22nd, 1963, and Reagan just slid in. The people just handed him every chance to win this election. This book says often national power is regarded in purely physical terms. You sometimes have to come in and inflict destruction. But sometimes there's power where you don't use physical force. The power of one individual or society over another is determined profoundly by the willingness of each to give in to the desire of the others. And this is a perfect example of when one group, the Reagan, the Southern Belt, the ammunition makers, the warfare state, wanted the presidency of the United States. All they had to do was stay constant, put in people they wanted in office, and make sure that they had this power without the average person even waking up. Now, there's more of us than there are of them, but they analyzed the lethargy, the indifference, the turning back from the assassination syndromes of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Adlai Stevenson, Dag Hammarskjöld, Ralph Bunche. Hundreds of people were killed, and the average person, as long as he had his entertainment and could make a buck and get through a day and have a couple of cars or beers or whatever it is that keeps people happy, not a word was spoken. I mean, not by the Sorensons or the Salingers or the friends of John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy, even the Allard Lowensteins keeping quiet until he was murdered. Where were and where are the friends that wanted to find out if the killer team did take power by killing, and if they did, remove them and expose them? Everyone was silent during the investigation of President Kennedy's murder. A few of us in the country were doing research. I was one of the 11 in the United States that began the day that Lee Harvey Oswald was shot. But we were in the minority, as you know. I mean, one of 11 is a pretty small group out of a country of 200 million. And this mushroomed into a group of authors, maybe 200 different authors on the Kennedy assassination at the most, and 50 or 60 of those worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. But we never had the support of the people to find out who was doing the killing. And the killer teams worked their way into power because they not only had the combined intent, but the victims whose slain leaders lay there with obvious conspiracies turned their back and didn't show any interest when the people were killed. This book on power says, in a contest between two men or nations equal in physical force, it will be the additional capability for affecting the human will that will determine what is more powerful. Now, I actually believe that this is a nation of equal force, people that may not want what Ronald Reagan is going to do. They voted against Jimmy Carter. They didn't vote for Reagan, but they wake up with Reagan as president. So that the intelligence or the force equal to the Reagan forces or the moral majority or the staunch conservatives, if they are totally inactive and their muscles are gone and their brains are shot so that when they get up in the morning, that seems to be the biggest event of the day, and they can't spend any time in studying what is happening, then the other opponent takes over, and that's what happened in this case. Now, this book gives an example when an inferior person in physical force sometimes proves themselves superior in human power, in their ability to sustain their will and achieve their purpose. And he gives the case of Mahatma Gandhi. He was a man, a leader, with six possessions, his glasses, his bowl, his spinning wheel, his sandals, his fountain pen, and his garment that he wove and wore. And he was able to chase the British Empire out of India, and 1 million people were amassed behind him, and the British left. But whatever Gandhi stood for, which was anti-British, no leader followed. Whoever killed Gandhi was never really written up as being aligned to any party that was doing vengeance for the activity he did. And the point is that when Gandhi was gone, there was no more leader in India to help the people. Now, this is the kind of material that Sartre, Beckett, and the existentials write about. We're going to talk about the future. You can't wait for a leader to come. He or she isn't going to be there. There's not going to be any leader. You didn't need a leader to get a good vote. Maybe we should get busy and more of us go to the League of Women's Voters and go to political activities in our local community. There isn't going to be another Martin Luther King. There isn't going to be a Gandhi. There is never going to be, for the black people, a Malcolm X. There never is going to be a John Kennedy. There's never going to be a Robert Kennedy who wants to break up organized crime or child prostitution or slave labor and blackmail and all the various extortion rackets that the organized crime do. There are going to be no more leaders. You are totally on your own. Either you mass with friends and people and line up and decide what kind of world you have, or you sit back and say, I give it to you, Reagan, and if my flesh burns, I hope it burns fast, because that's what he's counting on, and I think that's what's going to happen. It seems that if I were to have 14 people or 12 people over once a week for a discussion on what we should do, I don't think more than three of us would agree on the priorities, even among people who have listened to me on the radio for 9 years or have studied history. And if you get 12 people from the far right and you have a meeting like the Birch Society meetings, they don't take any if, and, or what. They have a sole purpose. They have one premise. They work for it, and they're getting their candidates into office. So if you're looking for saviors, forget it. And don't call my house. I turned off the phone the morning after election. I got 3 calls Wednesday morning and then unplugged the telephones at the house. I'm not your wailing wall. Don't call and cry. If you want to do something, I'll give you 4 suggestions and call after you do those. But I don't want to hear the sad story, because it's going to get sad, but figure it out, because you can't, except for those people that I know a long time who've kept up and done something. If you're politically active and you're involved and you show some extension of yourself out in that society other than a day-to-day existence, that is great. But if that's all you can do is just exist and complain, forget it, because I will continue working and I don't have time for that kind of business. There's a long article in the San Francisco Chronicle today, which is interesting because I want to spend the next few weeks, if the news doesn't break too rapidly, on the studying the history of the United States in 1863 up till 1963. An article in the Chronicle, 2 whole pages on history. The title was "The Time San Francisco Embraced Russia's Fleet," and on the second page, "The Union Needed a Friend, and Such We Have in Russia." And this is the story of Abraham Lincoln with his Emancipation Proclamation and Tsar Alexander II in Russia, who also had an Emancipation Proclamation. And Russia was helping the Union in the North in exchange for railroad expertise and a facility to transport their oil to become a major nation, along with other countries that were doing travel and exploitation and building up empires. The story of Russia was before the Soviet Union, helping us in the Civil War, sharing our technology, our industrialization, competing against Britain and Germany, Spain and France, lining up with the United States. At the same time that Lincoln had his Emancipation Proclamation, the Tsar in Russia, 1 year before he was murdered, Tsar Alexander II, had liberalized or attempted to liberalize his country in 1961. And he was murdered 1 year after the Lincoln assassination. And after he was killed, Alexander III came in with such extreme policies, the son of the murdered Tsar, that the repressions began in 1881, the anti-Semitic pogroms, the expansion into the Far East, the threats of England, the United States, and against Russia. And the pressure was on Russia internally and externally that brought Lenin and the Bolsheviks to power. But at the time of our American Revolution, the Russians were going through a process or attempting to break out and solve some of their problems there and industrialize in a way that almost would have been civilized had they been allowed to survive. And I wonder if the Southern Belt, the group that hates the Soviet Union so much, they've hated them since the revolution, but they might particularly hate them because history books can prove how they assisted the North in the time of the revolution, and that in turn kept our South from becoming industrialized. There's a linear connection from 1953 to 1963 in the Baku oil fields, the world's largest oil-producing center at the time in those days in Russia. Emmanuel Nobel, the munitions factory in Russia. The history of Russian oil and transporting the oil and ammunition and engines and power ships designed by the Nobels. I have several books, The Great Conspiracy by Michael Sayers and Albert Kahn, and another book on the Russian Rockefellers, the Nobels, the Russian Rockefellers. And going all the way from that time period of 1863 to 1963 in Dallas, there were families and people involved that came directly to the Kennedy assassination from the Baku fields. George de Morenschild, Lee Harvey Oswald's closest friend, and his CIA, the man that took care of him, his CIA agent in control in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, worked as a Nazi spy. He worked for the FBI and the CIA, and his father managed the Baku oil fields for the Tsar in Russia prior to the revolution when they were all kicked out. And at that time, they were rearmed with money by Herbert Hoover, who was supposed to be feeding the poor after the war. And they were funded with large amounts of money. And when the revolution, Russian Revolution came, Herbert Hoover began the institute in Palo Alto in 1919 with $50,000 to avenge and take back financial holdings he had in Russia. So the history of Russia and the history of Ronald Reagan's career and the octogenarians behind him that have waited for this juicy day, these theorists from Hoover Institute have direct lineage to the Romanov succession, to the Baku oil fields, to the assassination of John Kennedy. And hopefully I'll spend 2 or 3 weeks just on the Nobel family, the de Morenschild family, the Russian Revolution, Herbert Hoover, and the murder of John Kennedy to show you that these events are shaped by affecting each other. They're not isolated events. The putting of Ronald Reagan into power with the Hoover Institute, advisors controlling him all of his political life since the 60s, and now a large hunk of them will move to Washington, to the White House, to keep advising him and writing his speeches against the Soviet Union to hopefully avenge taking wealth, forests, minerals of people like Herbert Hoover, who actually had $1 billion investment in the Tsar's Russia before the revolution came. Ronald Reagan is the front man for a group that have nestled and studied and catapulted him. There was Richard Nixon first, and then Spiro Agnew was to be one of their successors. But Reagan has really been groomed and feathered by this team who are moving to Washington. And on the show this evening or next week or so, I'll give you a list of the cast of characters. One thing about assassinations and conspiracies through the years, we researchers have become what they call theorists, and the idea that political assassinations are conspiracies has always been put down. But now I saw somebody this week in gasoline at a station where we always have a dialogue, the far right challenging my theories. And the fellow who owns this station, a close friend, said to me, he was happy, of course, that Ronald Reagan was in it. He said, now he's going to be killed and Bush is going to take over. And I said, wait a minute, that's a conspiracy. You can't have it both ways. A single person killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And now you're telling me the trilaterals are going to kill Ronald Reagan and put in George Bush. When it's your man and you waited 12 years to get him president, you think a conspiracy is going to kill him. But when a Democrat comes in, that's not a conspiracy. So you can't have it both ways. Maybe the Republicans will get conspiracy-minded and they'll stop calling us conspiracy theorists. There is a book out called The Zero Factor, which a listener sent to me, by William Oscar Johnson. Every president elected since 1840 who had a zero in the year gets killed. William Harrison, 1840, Abraham Lincoln, 1860, Garfield, 1880, McKinley, 100, Harding, 1920, Roosevelt, 1940, and Kennedy, 1960. Everyone, every 20 years with a zero gets offed. So as I've mentioned before on programs, maybe we're not talking about Reagan at all. Maybe we're talking about George Bush. And if he's the vice president, he would work for, he would have the same people behind him. He was director of the CIA, and they'd be very pleased to instruct Mr. Bush on what to do. Being as he was director of the Central Intelligence Agency, he's really in a hierarchy above those schleppers at the Hoover Institute in terms of power. He had the ultimate power and also as ambassador to China. Regarding the zero factor, I had an idea about electing presidents of the United States that I want to share with you, and think about it because it's very hard to introduce new ideas. But this is the way I see it. In an age where political assassinations are so easy, there's questions of how Franklin Roosevelt died at Warm Springs, Georgia, the assassination of John Kennedy. There were plans to kill Richard Nixon to make Spiro Agnew president at the time of Watergate. If there's worry about Ronald Reagan and the successor, I believe that the president of the United States should be elected at the time of the national elections and or when he gets the nomination for his party. And after the election, he selects a vice president that he can work with. That, in other words, the vice president shouldn't be part of the killer team. Lyndon Johnson was all set to become president, and all Kennedy did was serve 1,000 days, and he was off. And the people behind LBJ, the Hunts and the Murchisons and John Connolly and the Texas hierarchy and the oil people, the Pentagon and Herbert Hoover and J. Edgar Hoover, the whole gang, J. Edgar Hoover, the whole group had Kennedy out of the way because they were waiting with Lyndon Johnson. Now, many people are afraid that George Bush is just sitting there waiting for the trilaterals, the Bilderbergers, to slip him into place. And Richard Nixon knew that Agnew would be his successor. As soon as that tape was on the door at Watergate, he got rid of Agnew fast before he had the lever was done in. And I think that in the case of Truman, he was put in with Roosevelt. He was not trained for the position. He had no international knowledge. And he went along with the National Security Council being formed and the atomic bomb and so forth. What I think we should do is have a president who selects his buddy that he can work with like a cabinet job as vice president, not somebody who would kill him or would get into power. And if the president is killed, have a national election and take another president. The man who succeeds him shouldn't have been part of the killing team in an age of the Central Intelligence Agency and bullets flying and so much subterfuge and murder. It seems to me that we should elect a president each time he's dead to make sure that the successor didn't kill him in order to become the successor. Now, this is the first half of this tape. You play around with that idea. We'll be back in 60 seconds. We're going to take a break and go on with some other ideas. But think about how to select a vice president so that we don't get somebody that they have put in knowing that he will be dead.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.